Park Place Meeting, Saturday afternoon, 19th June, 1976. Last Tuesday afternoon, we talked of meditation and the nature of meditation. That meditation in its reality is communion. And this word samadhi represents the peak of communion, the supreme communion. There are, of course, grades of communion. It is a little bit like this. If there is an eclipse, say, of the moon taking place, and it is going to be a full eclipse, there is a starting point for the shadow, and then it grows and grows and grows until the eclipse is full and complete. There is no moon light interfering, blotting out the light of the other stars as they shine. So too, as one enters into the deeper and the deeper states of communion, the separate self becomes completely eclipsed, and there is only the total self present, unobstructed by the separate self. Now, these different grades of communion are entered into usually in a certain sequence. One starts with being attentive to some particular subject or the figure of a great teacher or whoever it may be. There is a process of thought. Associated with that subject of meditation, as we call it. This is, if you like, a stage of musing in relation to that which you have selected to concentrate your attention upon. The mind tends to wander away sometimes. Now it is a most valuable practice to follow that to which the mind has wandered and pay attention to that. You become aware of that which to which the mind has wandered. And it reveals a great deal about oneself. Maybe what are one's special interests? What are one's fears? One's confusions, one's uncertainties, doubts, and so on. A great deal is revealed regarding one's own psychical state at the moment. Sooner or later, if one has the time to continue with meditating, the mind will come back to the original subject and it will appreciate how and why one's attention has wandered away. And you will notice that all this wandering expresses two things principally: the incapacity and turmoil of the mind, and secondly, that which holds the mind in bondage, because the mind wanders rather easily to where one's treasure lies, as we may say. And that treasure is usually just the worldly tinsel. One gets preoccupied with oneself and with all the desires and problems with which the self is faced. So, when you become intensely aware of that, you do not have forcibly to bring the mind back. But becoming aware of that, you will wake up naturally. You will wake up naturally to the subject in hand. And you can continue your meditation on the subject in hand, enriched by the knowledge of yourself, by the knowledge of what has obstructed the directing of your attention. It is important to know, to understand this. What has obstructed the directing of your attention? And so one discovers what the Buddha termed the defilements of the mind. You can read about those things in the texts themselves. Discovering the defilements of the mind, one realizes, or rather grows in the realization of the importance of purification and what purification means. Also, how purification takes place. We discussed this a little bit this morning. But this purification essentially takes place through the discovery of the impurity. And you find out, yes, this is in me, just as this is present in most human beings. There is therefore a sympathetic attitude, an attitude of understanding, of patience and forbearance. You do not castigate yourself. And it is very important not to castigate yourself. You get a guilt complex, you get an inferiority complex. I can't do it, I didn't do it properly, too bad, and all the rest of it. So one is in a state, the state of turmoil within the mind is preserved. Now, just see the fact calmly and see it with understanding, with kindliness, with compassion. And if there is compassion for yourself, there will not be stern judgment or hatred or aversion towards others. There comes the point when, as one becomes free of all those difficulties, those imperfect states of mind, unhealthy, immature states, which, generally speaking, one can classify under three great headings. You all know them: greed, aversion or hate, and illusion and delusion. Also, under fear, we may add a fourth one there. Fear is very important. You become aware of this in the right way, and in that awareness, they are thinned out of one's psyche. The psychical energy which expresses itself in an ill form is released, simplified, purified, and tends towards expression in a right form. A form which is conducive to the maturing of the mind, towards the ability to enter into intenser and intenser communion and remain in that state, realizing timelessness in its earliest stages. All this process involves concepts and words. The thinking process is just a stream of words. There comes the point when this stream of words becomes utterly quiescent. What is the importance of this? What is the significance of it? We must appreciate this very clearly. Every word stands for some object or person, for some event or mode of action, for some relationship, some qualitative description, and so forth. But all these are something finite, particular. They begin, they proceed, they die. That is to say, all this thinking process, the verbalizing process, lies within the sphere of mortality, the sphere over which death is Lord. And remember, this sphere is a mode of awareness. We are conscious in the mode of mortality. And being conscious in the mode of mortality, of separate finite particulars, means that we are within the prison house of duality, of multiplicity. Duality is the simplest form of multiplicity, the first and simplest form. We are in the prison house of multiplicity. Multiplicity, factually, there is throughout the cosmos. The trouble is that we are confined to multiplicity, confined to awareness in terms of the multiple, the separate. And in that state of confinement, we are largely unaware of the relationships between all the separate objects, things, person that make up the one total reality. This point we must understand very, very clearly. It is not that we can eradicate duality or multiplicity, or that we ought to, or anything like that. Not at all. It is all there as part of our total experiencing. If not for the fact of multiplicity, we could never move out. We could never grow into a sense of and a full enlightened awareness of unity and the true meaning of this unitary wholeness. So it has its place. There are those who come and say, oh, if I can only get rid of this duality and so on. No, you don't get rid of duality. There is nothing in the cosmos that one needs to be rid of. It has its place. Be sensible. We all go through this immature stage. We want immediately to sort of become one with the void or jump into it or so forth. All right, try and jump and see where you land. You land on good Mother Earth if you happen to land on both your feet elastically and not with rather an unfortunate bump. Well, you're all right. If you land with a bump, you will experience rather a fierce uprising of resentment and aversion, including aversion to meditation. So, be free of all that. Now, the word, therefore, and the concept, the particular mental construct, is all contained within this realm of mortality, the sphere of mortality, which represents our mode of awareness in that situation. It's the mode of mortality. That's how we are conscious. The mode of mortality means the absence of complete communion. Therefore, when the conceptualizing and the verbalizing process, and they go together, when that completely quietens down, something which has lain dormant in our own psyche, something which is a potential within us and has remained only a potential within the mind, begins to emerge into active manifestation. And this is the sense of unitary wholeness, in which gradually everything gets included. This sense intensifies through the various grades of communion. In Buddhist terminology, we have the four jhanas and the four samapattis culminating in the ninth, the cessation, as it is called. In the Brahmanical teaching, in the Upanishads, they divide it up only into the four avasthas, states of consciousness, as they call them. You see, the four avasthas. The first is the ordinary waking consciousness, where you are right down to earth, so to say, aware of things, separate things and persons and so forth. The second state of meditation they call the dream state. Now, this dream state has its correspondence in the first jhana of the Buddhists, where there is the conceptual activity going on, the thinking process going on. People have often wondered why the Brahmins used that particular term, the dreaming state. When you pay attention to something and get quite wrapped up in your thought and feeling, you become unconscious to an increasing degree of external things. You won't even hear the song of a bird or something like that. You won't hear it. You are completely wrapped up in your thought process. You are unconscious of the external things that are going on, the impressions that are flowing in upon you all the time. Now, that is the state of dreaming. It corresponds to the state of dreaming when you are asleep as well as when you are awake. In daydreaming, if in your daydreaming your daydream is extremely vivid, intense and strong, you are quite abstracted from everything around you. So they called it the dream state. Then comes the third state, where you are, according to the Brahmins, the Brahmin classification, in the Sushupti, the deep dreamless slumber state. Now, this deep dreamless slumber state is described as free of evil, free of fear. Free of confusion, utterly peaceful. Here they say the Atma regarded as the infinite embodied in the finite person. The Atma goes back to its own home. It goes, and they give similes like this. As when an eagle folds up its wings and goes back to its nest and rests in that nest. You see? This is this dreamless slumber state. But remember, although they use this symbolism, it doesn't mean that the body is asleep. Far from it. It is perfectly awake. And this is a state of awareness where there is no fear, there is no desire, and no evil whatsoever. You are actually in the pure state. In the Buddhist terminology, you get the second, third, and fourth jhanas involved. The Buddhist analysis is has more stages presented in it, second, third, and fourth, which corresponds to this dreamless slumber state. No concepts, of course, and no words in it. Also, you find that in the Buddhist analysis, you become free of the states of elation, rapture, and there is a going down of your former joys and sorrows. In the state where you get more and more into a pure communion free of thought and word, you are in tune with the psyche of the world. And that is full of sorrow, of confusion, of elation, of this disturbed state. So there is a responding to it, but devoid of concepts, thoughts, devoid of words. All this completely disappears in this state of sushupti. And if you are awake, and because you are awake, you really experience this transcendent state, this lighted up world. This is the reason why the great mystics, the great yogis who enter this condition are unable to describe it. How can you describe that which is empty of all that is associated with beginning, proceeding, ending? If separateness, finitude is out of the situation, there are no words in the language, in any language, to describe that. There is no description possible. It is a nondescript condition, but intensely vivid, intensely real. And in this peculiar way, you are aware of it because you are it. Now, that takes us to that third stage. There is gradually the movement, the emergence out of the experiencing as a particular person into the state of complete mergence, complete entry into the infinite. And again, what words we use will necessarily be words which separate the stages. In Buddhist terminology, you get the entry into the infinity of akasha, the infinity of vijnana. Akasha represents the void. It is the limitless void. It is the conditioned fullness, simultaneously. Now you see, terms like that are really meaningless unless and until one gets some sort of actual living touch through personal realization. It's extremely difficult to give any proper description of it. But here, there is a state of inexpressible purity, of an awakenedness into another dimension of being and consciousness, which we never touch here, in the ordinary way. What is it that obstructs this, prevents us from realizing such states? Every day, or all day, if we wish to. Sheer incapacity. What is the incapacity due to? What does it substantially consist of? All our own psychical impurities, the immaturity of the mind, the absence of freedom in the mind from the accumulated ideas, beliefs, and so forth. So, the brain itself is obstructive to realizing such a state. But when purification takes place, all these obstructions vanish. And in the absence of the obstructions, it is easy, it becomes easy to enter into that state. The Buddha, for instance, talks of these various stations of consciousness, as he calls them. And he says how, when a bhikkhu can enter into any of those stations as he pleases, when he pleases, and emerge out of them as he pleases, when he pleases, then he knows the freedom that is the supreme freedom, and higher than that, there is no other freedom. This is what he says. We can regard the entry into these profound states as varying degrees of intensity of the state of freedom which starts, in its true sense, with the cessation of conceptual thinking and verbalizing. Remember always the body being fully awake, not gone to sleep. This is what the Buddha presents. Now both the Buddhist presentation and the Brahmanical presentation and the presentation in different forms in the different mysticisms of the world, Christian, Sufi and any other, they all speak of this state as a state of indescribable bliss. This bliss is not pleasure. We have no verbal description. We have no conceptual faculty which can possibly tell us the nature of this bliss. But it is an utterly blissful condition. It is a state which heals the whole being. Heals the whole being to such an extent that in the Supreme Communion, there is a complete cessation of all separative perception and feeling. Perception and feeling not merely at our level, but at its transcendental level, when there is that separation, when there is that cessation, there is no decay of the organism during that period. It doesn't decay. Those perfected holy ones and their great disciples who had made the grade could enter that state and stay in it just like that, day after day. The Buddha himself mentions 7 days continuously. 7 days and 7 nights continuously. Try and picture what that implies. You don't eat, you don't drink. There are no calls of nature involved. There is no sleep. For 7 whole days and nights. In the ordinary way, if a human being is forcibly prevented from sleep for as much as 7 days and nights, there is very little chance of his remaining sane for the rest of his days. Remaining altogether sane. You see, something has happened to the organism by which a permanent transformation of the organism has taken place, and certain powers dormant within the organism now function freely. This is one of the things that happens with the true yogi. And I mention yogi specifically as such because yoga as such specifically is the way of power. I am referring to the Kundalini Yoga. It's the way of power. It's the way of deliberately bringing about a certain state and a result. The other yogas, they are all yogas. Dhyana Yoga, Raja Yoga, Bhakti Yoga, they are all yogas, if you like. Allow this state to emerge. I know that scholars, and particularly Indian, the people of India, would take issue with me in putting Raja Yoga in this class, and they legitimately take issue, because Raja Yoga includes the Kundalini Yoga. But on the whole, the element of letting the thing happen predominates over any bringing about of a result. Now, in this state of profound communion, what are you yourself, the person? Because the living person is just that living person. He is John Smith and not William Brown or somebody else. John Smith is there. What is John Smith in that state? He is a focus point, a nexus for the free inflow and outflow of transcendent energies. You may ask, well, what are these transcendent energies? Energy as such, I'm talking in the context of religion and matter spiritual and so forth, you see. Energy as such, as it works through the cosmos, expresses itself in our life and in the life of the other kingdoms of nature in certain great formal ways. To these ways we give names. The names which the great religions have for their archangels, their devas, their angels, their demons, their suras and asuras, and also the different vehicles they are supposed to utilize, they are all symbolical terms to express the archetypal forms which fundamental energy takes and functions throughout the cosmos and throughout the individual. These archetypal forms are the forms which are concerned with the particular kingdom of nature with which they deal, great archetypal energies. They are represented by the gods of the pantheons, for instance, the gods of the Rig Veda, the gods on Olympus, the Scandinavian gods, and so forth. How are they named? How do they get their names? Man observes the main modes of manifestation of life, life here and now. And you will find that when those who have this power to meditate in such a manner, that they enter into these states of communion, they become aware of these archetypal forces. That is to say, the particular forms in which primordial energy mainly manifests through us at a transcendental level. And the names represent the different ways, and the names correspond to the names that we know in ordinary everyday life. You have the father of the gods, just as you have the father of the family, and so on and so on. You have the different main functions. There is the goddess of love, the god of wisdom, the god of this, that, and the other, you see. But these are things which we know of in our ordinary life. And name giving cannot go beyond the bounds of language and concept. So these are symbolical suggestions of the way in which you become conscious of these archetypal forces. Now these archetypal forces have a dualistic nature. They can be pleasant and unpleasant. Zeus, you read the Iliad and the Odyssey. Zeus can either favor you or he can punish you. You know how, when you read the Iliad, for instance, he holds up the scales, and according to what happens in the scales, goes forth the decree that such and such a hero shall die now, or he shall triumph over his enemies. These archetypal forces function not dually in the sense of antagonistically, but in the sense of complementarily. When the time has come for the form to be discarded, then the messenger of Zeus comes along, or Zeus himself hurls his thunderbolt, and he is very, very accurate. He doesn't ever bother even to take aim. That thunderbolt goes right. You see, you have to remember that. It does go right. And there is, of course, the end of that hero. You have the same in Scandinavian mythology, Teutonic mythology. But what happens to the hero? Look how the mythology proceeds. If he has been a true hero, he is taken up into Valhalla, he is taken up into Olympus, or he becomes a star in the heavens, and so forth and so forth. We can understand, therefore, something of the nature of this activity of archetypal energies, even with our intellects down here. This is where the study of the mythologies is so very interesting, and it has a considerable importance, if we know how to study them. But now, John Brown, in the state of complete communion, he is an open vessel for the free entry, the unobstructed entry of transcendent energy, which, because of his utter purification, he is not a mere hero. Because of his utter purification, enables those energies to move out of his being as a blessing, a healing upon the world around him. This is the sort of thing that happens in these profound states of awareness. Very deep things. When the Supreme Communion is realized, there is no longer present any discriminative consciousness. Any consciousness which functions in terms of separating out one thing from another. There is the actual experiencing of the immensity. Immensity is a word which Krishnamurti uses. There is an experiencing of the one total reality. It is the experiencing of God, of Brahman, of what the Upanishads call realizing the Atma, and also expressed it as realizing Aham Brahmasmi, I am Brahman, the total reality. Now, when one returns to ordinary consciousness from that state, there is a permanent impress upon the psychophysical organism of that person. He is different, even physically different. And as and when such a thing manifests here and now in the Holy One, and it is witnessed by other people, they see him as the transfigured person. You take the transfiguration as presented in the New Testament. You take the transfiguration as mentioned in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, the Buddhist text, where Ananda sees him as all golden, sees the Buddha as all golden. And the Buddha explains the occasions on which this transfiguration of the body takes place. The body itself visibly is transfigured. It is not improbable that the very cells of the brain all undergo a complete change in certain ways. Whatsoever we think, feel, do, whatsoever are our natural characteristics, and above all, whatsoever are our memories, which have fixed patterns in the brain cells as such, all those are now absent. The cell structure of the brain undergoes a change. What sort of a brain is that? It is a brain which no longer offers any obstruction to the free and complete functioning of pure intelligence through that person, that man. And here you see one of the primary meanings of the word man fulfilled at last. The word man, which comes from man, the root man, meaning mind, meaning to think, meaning to create. This thought is not just a stream of words. It is not just a pattern built out of our separate petty little mental constructs. This thinking is synonymous with the creative activity of the world, of the universe, and through the universe. The creative activity of this creative energy, which is the unknown, the indefinable, the absolute. You see why these things it's practically impossible to write about these things and describe them. In the Bible, and God said, let there be light, and there was light. God said, the Bible puts it in terms of the creative sound. When you say something, there is a sound, the creative sound. How do you find it presented, for instance, in the Upanishads? In the beginning, there was only Brahman. And then the thing is repeated in terms of, in the beginning, there was only Atma. then they go on, he desired so and so, and the desire produced that which was desired. Can you and I desire and immediately produce it? If you were to desire there was a lovely Steinway grand here in the room, would it appear? No. But there is a profound reality involved in this type of statement. In those days, people found it far more difficult than we do today to try and use language which is less and less misleading and a little more successfully suggestive of those states and conditions. So, the meaning of the word man as this creative intelligence is completely fulfilled in the Holy One. There are all kinds of powers, as we say, liberated and freely functioning in the Holy One. But he never displays them. He never does. The Holy One never says, I am the Holy One, come unto me. I'll teach you holiness, I'll make you holy. He never does that. He stays quiet, silent. Whosoever is ready has just that, at least that amount of perception to thrill to the person in his presence. And if he approaches him, then he will find acceptance by the Holy One. Not otherwise. The true teachers never advertise themselves as teachers. Their teaching is the natural consequence of spontaneous action on the part of the learner. He who is concerned with being a full human being, longing to learn, which is the true meaning of wanting to be a disciple, discipulus, the learner. If that learner approaches the teacher and receives from him what is necessary and fit for his stage of development, confers teacherhood upon the teacher. I can desire to be the learner and go. But I cannot desire to be the teacher and establish a school of holiness, a school of wisdom, a school of liberation, and all that sort of nonsense. That is exploitation. That is the assertion of the separate self. Here is, on the part of the learner, the separate self goes, the conditioned person, in other words, approaches one who, because he is freed from all conditioning, will help me, the learner, to realize the unconditioned, will help me to awake. The teachers really are awakeners. We are in a state of sleep. We are in a state of a sick dream. And we have to awaken into healthy, whole reality. In this sick dream, desire, fear, confusion, ignorance, passion, ill-directed passion, they all play their part. What shall we do with passion? If we long to be learners, disciples, that passion becomes disoriented from the self and drawing onto the self and moves towards becoming unselfed, is directed towards the unselfing of ourselves. Then the miracle finally happens, that the true self, the supreme self, the perfect thing, the infinite, the unconditioned, is manifest through the limited, the finite, the particular human being. This is the marvel of it all. That is why man, through the ages, has, by some peculiar instinct, he doesn't know how and why he does it, but it happens. When a truly perfected Holy One has lived on earth, he is worshipped as the living God, the embodiment of God. And that's a true instinct. But if that perfected Holy One is indeed the perfected Holy One, he remains untainted by that worship. Utterly untainted. But if he gets tainted, then he will very easily and quickly demonstrate all the signs of those of the taint. One other thing. The perfected Holy One, in the profoundest states of meditation, realizing the unconditioned state, realizing the infinite, the immeasurable, the utterly whole, the holy, on returning to ordinary consciousness, has used in the past certain forms of expression. I will read you just a few sentences from this Tejo Bindu Upanishad. The term Tejo Bindu means the seed or the source of spiritual light. Tejas, light, Bindu, the seed. Now do remember, this divine dialogue form is the person himself, having realized the state of the unconditioned, he symbolizes the unconditioned with the name of one or other persons of the Trinity or one or other of the high gods and so forth. And in his ordinary everyday consciousness here, he uses his own name. So Kumara addressed his father, not his father of flesh, but the Father in heaven. And Shiva answers. Kumara says, "Please explain to me the nature of the Atma." To which Shiva says, "I am of the nature of the Supreme Brahman, the absolute totality. I am the supreme bliss. I am of the nature of divine wisdom. I am the I that has given up I. An extraordinarily significant statement. I am the I that has given up I. I am beyond the reach of mind and speech. I am purely truth, bliss, and consciousness, which is unconditioned and pure. I am the eternal. I am ever without speech. I am without the existence of beginning or end, of the nature of all illumination, of the nature of pure liberation. I am of the nature of consciousness itself. I am the nature of the all void.